Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Brian Vitale. Joining me, we got the usual crew. We have Josh Torres.
Hello. Hi. Salutations.
Mikhail Manani.
Hello.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Glazio.
Hey, folks.
And Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
Well, thank you all for holding down the fort while I was away last week. I was in a cabin in the woods, so nothing bad happened. And I just went out with some friends. They had their family owns a cabin in Colorado, so we were out for the weekend just enjoying nature, and it wasn't too cold. We glad it was this weekend, last weekend, and not this weekend for most of the U.S. So did you guys have a good time?
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Trails and a few other things.
A little bit of trails, mainly performance comparisons between different platforms. Thanks to Mikhail, we did some Dynasty Warriors talk for the most part. I don't know, it was a good time. It was getting through January. It's kind of a weird one. We're almost at the end of January and kind of at a weird standstill for this episode in a way.
Yeah, so obviously we've got a few games that are all circled for early Feb. We've talked about this. Obviously, Neo 3 and Dragon Quest 7 Reimagined kind of right on top of each other. The Kiwami 3 release dates right after that. Probably a few things I'm forgetting. But we do have a few more things to talk about in January regarding release dates. And of course, some news coming out of places like the Xbox Developer Direct. We have a few things out of that. But to start out, this is a game that I've seen covered on the site, but I am definitely not equipped to talk about, but people like Chow and Josh and others is the game Arknights Enfield. So maybe Zach Reese is listening to this podcast. I don't know, because he was a big Arknights fan.
RPG Site alumni, he's frequently in our mobile game channel Discord. Love, he loves, participating in the community about chatting.
I just remember him being like very into Arknights at one point. I don't know if he still is, but so Zach, if you're listening, just ping me in Discord. But anyways, Arknights Enfield. Chow, you were able to cover this for us, and I wasn't in the decision making room when you and Adam were kind of deciding how to cover this. You wrote a review for it. You didn't score it for a couple different reasons. So I don't know if you want to talk about like your review of the game or just your impressions as you got time to play it, what your thoughts are. If you have experience with Arknights, just the original mobile game before Enfield. So I'm just going to give you like carte blanche about talking about what this game is and what your thoughts were on it.
So basically, they gave me media access to it. They basically give you two options. You could either use an account where you start from scratch, or you could use an account where you have everything unlocked and you start in the middle of the game where the second region's unlocked. So that's how the review process was, right? Obviously, they did warn me. It's like, well, once the game comes out, your account's it's going to go poof. So, do you want to get
higher library? So it's like a fair and balance, for people. Like, there's no like, you don't have a leg up at the full live release. Everything
there's no wipe. There's no Kuritos in this place. No beaters.
Yeah, for that reason, is like I didn't like fully do the first region, or I do the starting account. I use the one that's in the middle where it has everything. So that's kind of like my idea.
So let's back up on the kind of the premise of this, right? Because this is kind of the first fully published thing from developer Hypergriff, who are mostly known for as the developer of Arknights, Griff Line, and all that stuff. And so with this one, Enfield is sort of like a sequel set in the far future from Arknights, and Arknights is a very different game from Enfield, where the original Arknights, who primarily on mobile, I don't know if it ever got a PC client or if that's eventually, I heard some word about that, but that was a really unique game where it's like it's primarily a tower defense game.
I was gonna say it's like tower defense, right?
You obtain units through the story and through rolling the gacha, and they all have like different roles on like the tower defense. Some are like supporters that heal, some do DPS, some are like attention grabbers where they get the attention of the enemy to kind of divert their attention. So like that whole thing is like a very different beast to Enfield, where Enfield is this 3D action RPG, where it's very much inspired by that whole movement from HoYoverse with Genshin and so forth. But this one is even though it's a 3D action RPG, it brings its own different flavor to the mix, where there's a whole factory building element to this, which used to be a major element in the game, where you're actually, you know, building factories from scratch and using those factories to gain resources to power up your characters, gain equipment from them, etc. So there is like a unique angle about this game that hasn't really been tried in this market before. Right, Chow?
Yeah, it's definitely unique in that aspect. I think the factory building thing is galaxy brain for me. So I good thing the game has this thing where you could share your code, your designs, and as long as you have the formulas, then you could just fucking steal their designs, right? So that's what I...
Yeah, so that's the thing. Like it's one of those things where they definitely, you know, through quality testing this game over the years of, like, how will this land for people? For people who don't really want to engage too much in the factory building aspect of it, they designed the system where people can, who are much more, you know, into the factory building aspect of this game, can share the blueprint code of their whole factory. And then people just have to plot that in. And as long as you have the resources to build it, you can basically copy what someone else has already built into your own game. And then you already have like something optimized for you, and you don't have to go through the process of having to do all the steps to emulate it. You already have it because of that code that they shared. So that's kind of like the concession with it. It's like, hey, we know our entire player base isn't going to be going over the moon for building factories. Some of them will, undeniably, but a lot of people, it's not for them. They're just there for, you know, the story, the combat, the world. They don't really, might not want to engage in that whole factory thing. But for people who are into the factory building, this seems very robust. It's very much, you're thinking about gathering materials and building up these buildings, putting in some input in the materials and optimizing like the conveyor belts, the factory lines, into getting the most optimal outputs possible depending on what stuff you need. And that, you know, obviously that'll take, you know, time for that whole thing to really flesh out. But
I'm gonna say, most people use Factorio as a comparison for this game. For the base building thing. I haven't played Factorio, but I, you know, when people give me screenshots of that game, they look very similar.
Yeah. How like, I know they've been kinda going back and forth over the combat in this game over throughout the, you know, all the numerous closed beta tests it's gone through and so forth. What? How did like, the final game's combat end up for you? Because I know a lot of people sort of compare it to Xenoblade in some aspects. So how does that go?
I think it's more like Final Fantasy 15 to me.
Okay.
In a way. It's like, okay, so you basically just get the mash attacks, but you have each button, like your number key, is like their skill for each of the character that's in your party. And then if you hold it, they'll use their ultimate, you know, that's kind of like how it was basic, right? But yeah. Depending on your combo strings, you could, like, have an extension attack. And enemies also have, like, a stagger bar, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's got, like, the Final Fantasy thing in there. But the thing I like about the stagger version of this is more like, you know, elements from different games. Like, yeah, I could see the Xenoblade vibes, you know, it's like you had to do the QTE to do your combo strings. But I feel it's more Final Fantasy 15 to me, and I think combat really shines when you fight like a difficult boss, not when you're like fighting like mobs. Because if you're fighting mobs, you're just like mashing buttons, obviously, right? I think that's like the combat in all gacha games. Like trash mobs, it's like you'll never see the combat shine, right? You need to fight a boss, right?
Yeah, I mean, even in Xenoblade, in some aspect, like, you know, the strongest parts about the Xenoblade games is the boss battles, because you actually have time to do, like, those element chains, and then, you know, it varies between each Xenoblade game, but for Xenoblade 2, for example, you're able to get those element orbs going, and then start to smash them when you build it up, like, and it's like, that was probably the most fun aspect of Xenoblade 2's combat, is given that time to really let loose on that whole element arts bursting chain, whatever it was called.
There's definitely like Xenoblade elements. Like, there's like one character, like when she uses her special skill, there'll be like, you know, like her dolls are in the ground. You can pick them up to get some buffs, right? It's kind of like, it reminds me of like Xenoblade 2 when I don't know, when you're doing like combos with Rex, like there's like these little green objects in the ground and you just pick them out, right? And then
yeah,
so it got similar element vibes. I like some of the things that when you fight bosses, like obviously you have like the kind of like the Final Fantasy 14 raid designs, you know, it's like, oh, here's a bunch of rocks, go hide behind it, or as you get hit from the AoE or something like that, right? And then it's like, if you see a boss is glowing, it's like he's using this ultimate attack and one of your party members are in danger. And as long as you have a skill ready, you can like get them out of trouble, right? You know, there's lots of stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, you have to like manage your skills, right? And I think it shines. It's just, it takes a little while to get going, right? I think.
It's always kind of the, you know, it's not even just, it's not even like exclusive to like free-to-play action RPG games. It's like a lot of other RPGs, it takes time for the combat to really shine, get going. So like the early hours of it, when you're getting introduced to these characters, getting built up, like a lot of the combat elements won't really come into play until much, much later into the game. Just kind of almost inherent to the genre in some aspects. But I imagine like, you know, the combat in this game definitely has, I assume, like different interactions between the characters. Like, hey, you're building up one element and you're able to like, let's say like you put the enemy on fire or something, can you use another element to do more damage to an enemy that's like on fire, like it has the elemental interaction? Is there anything like that? Like, I know it's kind of a simpler
there is
okay, so there's like incentive to like build like teams that will synergize with one another because of those, I imagine.
Yeah, because it's like in the review access build, they give you this one team, and that one team is kind of suitable for the first limited character, Levaficin. Like, she's, I guess they call her like a clone of Satyr, because Satyr is like in the OG game, because they look kind of similar or something. I don't know too much about the OG Dark Knights. All I know is that if you play this game, and if you play the OG Arc Knights, you'll be depressed, because in the intro, you basically go through the moon, and there's like all these gravestones, and they're like names of like characters from their OG game that are all dead like that.
Man.
So if you see that, you'll be depressed or something like that. That's what the fans are saying.
That's kind of like a weird thing, because Arc Knights, the original game, is still going and still getting new story updates and still getting updates, events and stuff. And so like for this game to come out while that game is still going and say, hey, these characters that you know in that OG game that's still going might just like inevitably die, you know, and that's how it's represented in this game.
Yeah, I've vaguely heard that this game is not really connected to Arc Knights other than it takes place in the far future. Is that just supposed to be a sort of simple but weird way just to kind of indicate like, yep, this game takes place way after that game, so all your favorite characters are dead?
I mean, there's people that like their excuse is like, well, some people are immortal, right? And technically, that means that character gave up their mortality to die or something like that.
That reminds me of when I, at Tokyo Game Show, when I talked with the devs for Stories 3, they confirmed that Naviru is not in the game, because it's like, yeah, this takes place hundreds of years after like 1 and 2, so he's dead. And it's like, okay.
All right. When you play Stories 3, you're going to, there's a side quest to find Naviru's gravestone, his headstone.
Yeah, basically, you've covered a lot of stuff, but I want to just bring up one point from your review and what you've discussed with me. You said this is like a fantastic looking game. So I wanted to ask you, since you play Wuthering Waves, everyone I know who plays that says it's the best looking gacha and like one of the best looking games they've played. So how do you think this compares to that in production values?
I think they're about equal, but they're like a different art style. One that goes for more like anime art style. This one goes for like the more 3D. And I think this is like anime done right. I wish like more anime games look as good as this game, to be honest. Like, this is like the most beautiful gacha game I have ever seen. And when I was like showing off this game to my friend, it's like, isn't the graphics nice? And he was completely sold on the graphics too, right? And this is coming from a guy who spent maybe more than $100,000 on Genshin, right? So he's like,
yeah. I mean, yeah, they definitely nailed, like, you know, the like, it has a definitely very distinct art style to it. I do like that. It's like it differentiates itself enough to a very saturated market already, especially visually, where a lot of people kind of do that very vibrant, cel shady, you know, kind of almost aping on Genshin's, you know, art style to, you know, get those people on board. But this goes in a very different direction. I do like, especially the UI design. Like, I can't say like how the user experience is in the game, but the aesthetics of the menus itself is very, like, the black and yellow aesthetic they're going for is really interesting.
I'm looking at some screenshots, and it looks like Arknight Enfield, it's especially environments, a lot of other, like, Genshin or Hoyo games, like, everything is cel-shaded from environments to, you know, grass to everything. Where this one, the environments are, they're still, like, obviously stylized, but a little bit more, like, realistic. So, yeah, there's a bit of a difference in the, when I look at, like, comparisons, the environments are, Genshin is more pure, like, cel-shading, and this is a little bit less so, I guess.
Yeah, of course, you know, this is free to play game with gacha elements, and there's been a lot of discussion around our Enfield's gacha system. A lot of discussion from the community, from people who, you know, may are kind of looking in from the outside. We don't have the time to really go through this physical, like, exactly how the gacha works, Chao, because it feels like people have been making spreadsheets and infographics on how this gacha system works. I guess
I got flagged on Twitter because I said that I want dupes, because I play a lot of games. It's like, if I like a certain character, I want a dupe so I get all their passives, right? You know, it's like, if you want a dupe into the game, you won't get it.
You'll never get it. So, okay, so obviously, for people who may not know, in these games, even before Genshin, like, almost like inherent to the genre when it was, like, first introduced, when you get characters in this game, you'll get one copy of them. If you get multiple copies of them, they usually have will power up the character in some way. Like in Fate Grand Order, if you get dupes of a character, you'll power up their essentially their ultimate attack. In Genshin, in the Genshin games, they'll add like new properties to the characters and their move sets and so forth, and obviously power them up along the way. This game tries to disincentivize getting dupes in a way where, you know, you're still powering up the character, from what I understand, when you get dupes in this game, but getting multiple copies of a character is almost a shit show. It's trying to incentivize you to getting at least, you know, one copy of a character in an almost sort of reasonable rate, because essentially, if you save up 120 pools for a character, so if you roll a 10 banner 12 times, you are guaranteed that character's rate up character no matter what, from what I understand, right, Chao? If you get the worst luck, and that's like the worst of the worst, you know.
Yeah, it'll take 120. Because this game has no 50-50, like, or your 50-50 can keep going losing, right? In Genshin and Wooa or a lot of other games, it's like once you like get an SSR, you go to this thing called a 50-50. It could be either the featured unit or someone else. If you get someone else, the next time you do it, it'll be guaranteed the character that's featured on the banner. So it's called a 50-50 system, right? But this game, you could just keep losing the 50-50 forever. It doesn't matter if you didn't get the limited unit. You could just keep losing it forever. And then once you hit that 120, then you'll get your character, right? So that's the one thing, right? I'll tell you, my luck in the media access, I did not win the 50-50 even once. Okay?
They gave you like a lot of like roles in this simulated environment. Obviously, like I said, all that is wiped. It's not in the live game that was released.
Yeah, but they gave me 300 roles, and I couldn't even get a single, like, I didn't even get like one 50-50 one. So that tells you my luck.
And that's kind of been the ongoing thing throughout the community. Like, you know, discussing gacha systems between per gacha game that like comes out is like it's already a losing proposition, because the whole, in my opinion, I've held this opinion for years, the whole inherent nature of a gacha system, you know, is predatory by nature. Just because, you know, one game quote unquote does it better doesn't, you know, automatically a better game than the other one. Like, it's all inherently who is the biggest loser in this.
it doesn't. But for me, is like, if the game has a better gacha system, then I'm more willing to put up with it, right? But but we didn't really get why I hate the gacha system besides about constantly losing 50-50. So one of the reasons is that this game didn't desensitize you from like trying to roll for additional units. It's basically like once you get the unit at 120, the next time you try to get the character, it goes to like 240. So you're like, oh, you want a dupe? No, you want it's 240. And the worst part is they make all these currencies are limited. Like in other games, you could save up whatever currency you have, but this game really wants you that you, if you got the currency, you had to spend it within this banner. So it's like trying to drive up FOMO, and you become
carryover pity. So like let's say you saved up pity to like 110, that wouldn't carry over to like the next banner. It would restart at zero.
Yes. So you it's either or nothing. So there's no 50-50 or constant 50-50 loses, and then currencies are constantly limited that you earn, and any free currency that you earn, it's also limited, so you have to spend it within the banner, so it's very hard to save. And then it's like, you know, it's because it doesn't
it's kind of a weird one, right? Because like there's so many different things that Enfield is doing, because it feels like the most quote unquote healthy, I'm very, very heavily quoting the unhealthy there, mentality or approach to this is like, hey, if you want a unit, a future unit, save up 120, don't roll until this unit is unfeatured, so at least you can guarantee it.
Yeah.
But along the way, like what it's doing right now is the next two rate up characters coming to this game are already in that pool in the game, so you could accidentally get future characters that are going to be on rate up in this game, from what I understood in research. So, like, the next two characters on rate up is already in that pool that you can roll in the game. So you can accidentally get future rate up characters right now as you're rolling to get the current rate up characters. So you can accidentally get them, which is a weird ripple to it. And there's also like other systems in the game where if you reach a certain, like, say 30, I forgot, it's like 20 or 30 characters, they'll give you an extra 10 rolls, but those 10 rolls don't count into the pity. It's just like a free 10 roll, but it doesn't like count into the overall pity that like you're working towards, which is also weird. And there, and then you also flow into the mix of like how the weapon, the separate weapon banner goes into the mix, and how, you know, are those high rarity weapons worth rolling on for the character that you're going for as well? And that gets
into murky territory. Like, it gets very confusing. Yeah. There's like so many different currencies in the game. I'm like, could you just make it simple and just have like just one or two currency and call it a day?
Well, this is how they get you. This is how free to play games get you, where they have so many currencies. Like they, they try to confuse players deliberately.
I think there was like 10 different currencies. There's a currency from rolling, and it's spent. And once you roll, you get like this blue currency. It's called the Arsenal Ticket or something. And then that currency can be used for like buying weapons or something. And then it'll be like, oh, and then if you have extra dupes, you have to like manually convert it to the same kind of currency.
There's not a problem exclusive to this game. I just want to make that clear. There's not the single out Enfield for doing this. Like many, many, many other games in the genre do a very similar thing where the currency that you're buying is then converted to like, say, like, you know, another currency that's the one that's actually used to roll the banner. You know, it's very universal.
You can trace that all the way back to like Microsoft points. Remember that era?
Yes.
Or $10 with 800 points or whatever. So it was never like a clean match. And I'm sure like that's not even the genesis of that either. That's just my formative one of thinking about that.
People say
it's very economic sort of one of like maximizing, you know, profit from people.
I feel like this game just took like every greedy approach and just crank it up. It's like, it's like it's bad, but let's just crank it up to the 11. It's like, okay. And then that's basically what you get. It's like, obviously, if you like the game, you're just going to put up with it, right? I'm just saying, I'm not going to spend money on this game. And after the whole debacle of what happened when the game first launched, like, this game basically had, like, the perfect launch. The game was so well optimized. The servers run, like, smooth as butter. It's like, it is, like, the perfect launch. Except the fact that the one thing, the most important thing, the PayPal payment system.
Yeah, so the there was a really, really, I'm kind of surprised that like this wasn't more widely reported, because this is like, this is liable to legal ramifications for that studio moving forward. Like, this is not the end of the story. But when this game first launched, well, of course, you can, you, if people want to put money into the game to get currency, you know, many, many players do this from the get-go. They, you know, obviously, if they're on mobile, they use, you know, Apple Store or the Google Play Store as their payment processors if they're playing on mobile. What if you were playing on PC, one of the ways you can pay is through PayPal. And the PayPal integration with this game was very, very busted at launch, where people, it was basically a huge security leak and breach, where if you linked your PayPal account into this game, people had free access to your PayPal too. You would see charges and other other currencies or the same currency, and it was basically people's purchases could show up in your account. So many people, if they had their PayPal linked, they would see other purchases they did not make in their PayPal. So they saw like purchases of like people purchasing like the monthly pass or battle pass in different currencies in their account. And that's like really, really fucking scary, because you didn't know when this was going to end. Like, so it was like not just from another person's account, it was like multiple people's accounts, and they're using your PayPal account. Thankfully, they caught on to it relatively quickly, so they shut down the PayPal option to make payments. But it's one of those things where this is such a, like, it's not even, it's like the problems with this is not even just that. It was also, for instance, one of the reported problems is when you're purchasing like the monthly pass or battle pass, it would charge you incorrect amounts of that. So let's say this $10 battle pass, you choose to pay for it, it would charge you like $1,300 in one case, you know? And it's like, what the fuck is going on? You clearly did not pay that amount for this very little thing. That was also one of the reported problems with this whole debacle. And at that point, many, many other quote-unquote normal game companies would immediately shut down their game to investigate this problem and fix it entirely. What they did instead was just, oh, we'll just shut down the PayPal payment processor and keep the servers live and everything live in it. And that, to me, is insanity. Like, it's like, there's already a huge, huge, huge security risk. And what you're basically, and what they told people, it's like, oopsie, sorry, please use another payment processor for a very, very serious, diabolical issue with the game. So you, because they were just like, oh, just keep on, you know, because they didn't want to shut down their revenue stream. And they didn't want to look bad to, you know, people who...
And they kept pretty silent about it, which is... it tells me all you need to know.
It's weird that, like, people don't make a bigger issue out of this, because I'm like, that's a really, really, really serious problem, and...
I think they just didn't care, because to them, PayPal is an international company. To them, it's like, this is a Chinese company that made the game, so that's not their main concern. If the Chinese payment system had a problem like WeChat or something, or Alipay, I think then they'll be like, oh, we gotta shut this off. But it's PayPal, so it feels like it's just like a, you know,
There's definitely been reported cases out there where people lost thousands upon thousands of dollars through this fucking quote-unquote bug. You know, it is a bug, yes.
Some people are completely screwed too. It's like, if they didn't get the refund in time and they have rent due, well,
overdraft fees, they're not gonna fucking, you know.
Yeah, they're not gonna refund that either. Fees.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so, but I mean, they eventually, like a day or two later, did issue full refunds of legitimate and illegitimate purchases, but that doesn't cover, like, obviously overdraft fees or people who got completely screwed, because some people have their bank tied to PayPal. So if they don't have a PayPal balance, it'll charge their bank balance instead. And, you know, that is bad. That is simply, like, it's really, really shameful, you know. And to me personally, you know, not judging people who, like, play this game still, I'm just like, I would be seriously concerned every minute, every second I'm playing this game moving forward because of a thing like this. Like, if they have security breaches like this already, you know, like, how can you trust this company, man? I'm just saying.
I mean, it can't really affect the iOS and Android payments, because those you have to like manually authorize on those things. It's not like an account, once it get access for authorized payments, you have to like do it literally every time. So I think those would be fine, but I get your point that this is something which they need to like put out a proper statement and like say that this will never happen again. Not, this goes beyond just giving people like free rolls, basically.
Yeah. This is beyond comment. This is like, I have to imagine someone at that company is going to face very, very, very severe consequences behind the scenes for this fuck up. Maybe multiple people, you know, and this will have ongoing like legal ramifications down the road for that company that will happen behind the scenes, because they don't want to, you know, look bad in front of people. Like, there will probably be, you know, court matters, you know, for this fucking debacle. Rightly so, because I can't imagine how many people got fucking chewed over, potentially life-ruining, you know? And we just will never hear of those stories behind the scenes. But they should come to light, you know? It really should be... I just felt really weird. Like,
shouldn't just be an oopsies.
Yeah, yeah. That's how it's like, to me, it's like really weirdly silent. It's like, man, not a lot of people are like publicly reporting this. Like, that's crazy. Like, you know, this is kind of one of the biggest things that's happened in this space.
I guess in the
but it's not a small game either. Like,
yeah,
it's had like 35 million pre-registrations. That's like bigger than most games would like get in general throughout their lifetime. So it's not a small game.
I mean, obviously, like, it is definitely. For the PR people there, it is their best interest to cover this up as much as possible, obviously. And that is, you know, understandably so, they're trying to cover this up as much as possible. But I think more people should do their due diligence, kind of making this more widely available. And I mean, like, spreading this info in a more public manner. Like, I think that's the responsible thing to do. It's like, hey, you know,
there's not really
be careful.
It, but I'm wondering if like they could do almost like a, is post-mortem the right word, where they say like, here was the technical issue that led to this, and here's how we're correcting it. Like,
yeah,
something along those lines. That would be how you would address it.
I think that the more responsible thing is like releasing like a public statement and doing like, mm-hmm. Hey. Yeah, and
the detailed technical would be like a part of front-facing statement.
Yeah, and that's something that shouldn't be coming, like, even if you're planning to do it, that shouldn't be something that you do like a week after. You should be trying to do that as soon as possible. Don't keep people in the dark, deliberately. So, you know, that's how it is. And for many people, it's like, well, it didn't affect me, so who cares? You know, that's the majority's stance on it. It's like, yeah, I wasn't screwed over, so I'm fine.
You know who wins in this situation is the people that hacked. So basically, if you were able to cheat someone's account, you get to keep all that stuff, because they're not going to, you know, try and take your stuff away, right?
It's kind of a weird scenario, because like in order to quote unquote part, like, be as part of it in the first place, you need to have your PayPal vulnerable in it. It's just kind of a weird bad scenario all around.
You know,
just independent of everything else, which I know is a loaded statement. Like, if I wanted to play this game and not spend a dime, like, what's my experience like?
Well, I just don't get the cool characters that they will feature all the time. You just gotta suffer through that. That's
it's one of those things. Like, there's not, this game hasn't been out for so long that people don't really know the free to play currency, or the currency that they're giving out on a monthly basis. So it's hard to find like what the pattern is going to be, but as of right now, and unfairly so to this game, it's too much in its infancy to really know like what's going to be like the monthly income for of the currency to roll characters. Obviously, out of the gate, people are in their honeymoon period, where it's like, wow, they give out so many, a lot of freebies. They're giving out like 130 plus rolls for, you know, for free.
People are pretty mad out there. People said that the pull currency sucks in this game. You don't even earn that much. In fact, you had to clear out the entire game from beginning to end to even get like 200 rolls.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. That was part of the rationale for making this kind of an unscored review, because it's like a service game. It's a gacha game. Just putting a number on it at day zero just really doesn't seem, regardless of monetization or anything, just like, how do you put a number on something like that when you kind of need to see like what's the game going to be like in 1 month, 2 months, 6 months, a year, if it's going to have like a tail like that.
That's always that kind of weird thing, but like reviewing games as a service games in general, because like the games will inherently change over time. Mm-hmm. So putting a numerical score on these games at any point in their lifetime is like, it could be a 5 out of 10 off the gate, and then like version 2.0 will hit and it'll become a 7 to 8 out of 10, and then version 2.3 will come out, and then it like they'll do changes and it'll feel like a 4 out of 10 game. Like, how do you even put a fucking score on these games?
Phantasy Star New Genesis, where 1.0 comes out and it's not very good, and 2.0 comes out and still not very good.
And yeah, that's also a weird thing to like evaluate. It's like, how does this game's gacha system compare to other games' gacha? Is it better? Is it worse? Am I getting screwed over less than other games? It's like, how do you even evaluate that?
I feel justified.
At the end of the day, a review is how you feel. Like, you know, when you're evaluating a game, how do you feel about the game? Like, there's no review that's going to be objective about a fucking game, like, inherently. It's like, a review at the end of it is like, hey, how do you feel about the game? Do you feel as good as bad? What are the good aspects to you? What are the bad aspects to you? What are the aspects that didn't, you know, really... That's all a review is.
It's always been a substantiated opinion. Like, you need to provide evidence, but it doesn't mean your opinion's a fact. It's just a substantiated opinion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I think I did my job right.
Chow's review is up on rpgsite.net for Arknights Enfield, so blame him in the comments if you don't agree.
But in general though, like, beyond, you know, the really 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 awful things, especially with the PayPal stuff, it is impressive that like, hey, this is a well optimized game both on PC and mobile. Like, they found a really solid foundation to build the game upon. You don't have to like wait for like weird optimization fixes. It's like, hey, this is from the get-go. Obviously there are always going to be like improvements you can make, but they are starting from a good spot optimization wise on all the platforms.
I even got the game like running on my Android tablet, and man, this game is still beautiful on my tablet. Obviously this tablet has the top of the line specs on it, but you know, it looks 70% as good as it is on PC. So I think
Which is better than most games, like, you know, who in the space that try to like, you know. Like, I remember Mothering Rage 1.0 on mobile was like fucking dire, you know.
Holy shit. I wish like Duel Night Abyss looks half as good as the game. Sorry. Yeah,
like, the game has so many fucking problems that I don't. That game is like, it is in purgatory right now. Like, I don't know how they're going to turn things around. They have so many
people. People are not happy in current state of the game, but I still keep playing it.
Yeah, I mean, I play it once in a while. I think yesterday was the first time I didn't like boot up that game at all.
It's like rip.
Well, I mean, I'll still play it, but I'm just like kind of, I don't, you don't have to play that game day to day, daily, which is the nice part about it. It's like, you don't have to do a daily login and feel like you're missing out, really.
I imagine that's a little thing here. But anyways, Arknights, I love everything about this game, except for the gacha, and now even like the payment system.
the monetization aspect is its worst part, like most of these games. Crazy, I know. But I mean, it's cool that it's doing its own thing with the whole factory thing, and the way that you can like pop up like zip lines in the game, and you can like travel like almost like Death Stranding in a way where you can like kind of traverse through the game through zip lines that you made.
I will say, as someone who doesn't really touch gacha games much, like, I will say that the building aspect does really help Enfield stand out. Like, oh yeah, this is that one. Where some of the other ones, like Ananta versus Zenless Zone Zero, like, I kind of get like confused in my head because I see them as too similar on their face. But this one's like, oh, this is the one that has the building mechanic, which I know is not the only one that has something like that, but it does help distinguish it. IMO.
It is definitely funny that like when people like share something about the game for Enfield, it's like they're sharing their factory layouts versus like, hey, look at my team setup or whatever. It's like, no, here's my fucking factory layout. And that's kind of like the most popular thing that people are sharing. It's like, this is how I optimize like my factory for this thing. Do it. It's like, that's funny. That's cool.
Yeah, I even got friends that got into this game, and they're getting into it for the factory building thing. I didn't really like the factory building for me personally, because there's so much tutorial, because the game is trying to like handhold you to the max on the factory building part, right? It'll be like, oh, you had to build a power grid, you had to do this, and then you had to make sure the lines are connected properly. It's like,
my brain just does not wire in that direction. Like, games like Starfield and Fallout 4 and 76 that had like all those like light building mechanics, where I'm like, how do I apply power to my windmill? And then I go online and someone's like, I built this giant fortress with 18 layers and, you know, movable floors, that I'm just like, I'm going to go to the other part of the game, because my brain does not do this.
I can definitely understand like why it feels over tutorialized, because they're so afraid of people like just bouncing off of the game. They don't know what to do in that game. And you know, there are some people that will never get the factory aspect, no matter how many tutorials and force tutorials.
Yeah, I would not engage with it. I would just steal someone else's design. I didn't sign up for this. I signed up for the basically the anime look. I think this game just, it's beautiful, and I think I just want to get into the game just for that alone.
It's kind of like in a weird, like, here's my impression of Arknights Enfield. It's like the most fleshed out part about it. Like, if you were to take out one system in that game that's the most fleshed out, it is that factory building aspect, and everything else in comparison feels like it doesn't, like, it doesn't feel as fleshed out as the factory building aspect of that game. But it's kind of like the weird thing. It's like, so if you're just gonna like use someone else's blueprint to optimize everything, and you know, you don't want to put any thought into the factory aspect, what you're left with is less fleshed out aspects of that game, which is like, it's too early in its story to really flesh out, like, you know, where it's heading. And the combat itself and the characters, that the way that their kits are designed, it's not like, it feels like the story, the characters, the combat, they were a means to an end, which is the factory of that game. it really does feel like, hey, they really thought a lot about like how to flesh out the factory system in that game and the factory building at the expense of everything else, kind of feels half baked in service of them. That's what I think.
Go ahead and check out Arknights Enfield review from Chow up on RPGsite.net. And I don't know if it's got a presence in like our Discord, like Mobich chat.
Oh, people are definitely playing it. The mobile game people are definitely playing it. Yeah.
All right, cool. Good to know that there's like a community there.
It's got like our Mobage channel is a wonderful blending of like pleasant communities, because there's definitely an Uma Musume community. There's a Fate Grand Order community, very active there. It's kind of like an interesting blend of like new and old. If there is like a somewhat popular mobile game, there's definitely at least one or two people in there playing it.
It's kind of cool. All the game that I play, no one talks about it anymore. No one barely talks about Honkai Star Rail. No one plays Epic 7. Nobody plays Grand Blue, except one guy.
So, I tune into Do It Night Abyss once in a while, but it's not like I'm just,
yeah, no one talks about it for me and you, so
yeah I don't know, I just kind of like not in that chase. Like, I feel like the next one I'll think about the trying out is Ananta and what was the Neverness to Everness. I think I'll try maybe I'll try.
I'm thinking about playing Silver Palace, that's about it.
I don't know yet about Silver Palace. I feel like the combat isn't... It's too early, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I will. But at the end of the day, if there's like at least representation for those games, it's usually you and me, Chow, who will dip our toes into them. It's like, we're stupid enough to try them. Why not?
And that was the main game that we had circled to talk about this week. Mikhail, did you want to talk about what you had finished before the podcast? Just, you know, as a, you know, side conversation, as a tangent.
So yeah, there's this game from Ad Hoc Studio called Dispatch, which I thought was just going to be because Ad Hoc Studio has a lot of people who worked on Telltale's The Walking Dead, which I enjoyed a lot. But then I also thought most of the games Telltale made after that were quite bad, and they made this Game of Thrones game, which I think is one of the worst games I've played in my life. And it was the one game which got me to stop doing trophies, like going for 100% completion, because that game was just a waste of time. But I heard a lot of good stuff about this game called Dispatch, and I thought it was going to be the same thing. So I finally got around to it, and it's actually kind of interesting. It's like a blend of, it's a superhero comedy game, but it actually has this management simulation aspect where you play as a dispatcher who sends out like a team of superheroes depending on what basically crimes are taking place in the city. All people need help and stuff like that, and you're just sending out your superhero team based on what skills they have, and you get like a rating at the end of it. And I didn't expect a simulation thing like this, because when my friend told me, oh, there's some gameplay, but it's still mostly like a decision-making thing. And I thought it was just going to be like a TV show where you know, like The Walking Dead, one of those things. But no, I've played half of it, like as of this recording. Like I spent about 4 hours on it today. I thought I would finish it before we record, but just got busy with some other stuff. Enjoying it a lot. Like I absolutely recommend it if you have access to like playing games on Steam or PS5. It's coming out on Switch 1 and 2 next week, but I've been playing the Steam version mainly today, at least. So I recommend looking into it at least. It's kind of this, like I've seen some people say it's like cringe writing or whatever, but I don't know. I like Life is Strange a lot. I've played all of those games, and I'm enjoying like playing this as a break between long and like complex RPGs. And I also have been like playing Inazuma 11, but I'll get to that when I actually finish it for my review. But yeah, Dispatch, enjoying it a lot. I might talk about it a bit when I finish it, when we record next week, but so far it's impressing me a lot, and I'm glad I'm finally getting around to it. So yeah.
And I know it's been making like it's been like seemingly a good word of mouth, and it kind of made a lot of appearances at different like end of year game awards, you know, showcases and streams and lists.
The one interesting thing is, like, you know, episodic games, I just roll my eyes now when that happens, and I'm like, just release the whole thing. I don't want to like play stuff based on one of these things. But this is one of those rare episodic games that kept like exploding every single time a new episode reached, and this like the Steam CCU just kept going up, unlike usually how these things go. So in this case, I guess it worked for them.
It kind of helps, because that whole thing was already done before it released. So they just released new episodes weekly after a certain point. So like for like the next 3 or 4 weeks after it came out. So you didn't have to wait months like The Walking Dead for a new episode, because they deliberately released it piecemeal, but even though the game was already done fully on that end. Yeah. So that really helped that to keep momentum going on that. So now, you know, everything is out. You don't have to wait anymore for new episodes. And also, like, the game was originally conceived as a TV show, and once they kind of got the no-go to make it a TV show, they're like, okay, we'll just rework it into a game, and that really helped out.
That makes sense, because the visuals are, like, insane. Like, I never expected to see. This is like a, you know, one of those Sony animation movie tier things, according to me. So, and when I see people saying, oh, this was amazing, I can't wait for Dispatch to like next year, I don't think it's going to be so soon.
I don't think
like,
it'll be next year. No, like, definitely not.
This the amount of animation work over here is just incredible. And they have to like take into account every choice you make, because I've had some decisions now where like some character is just not going to be there. So how do they handle those scenes where that character is in and stuff like that? So they have, like, I don't know how long this was in dev. I'll probably look into it when I finish it. But yeah, it's just
very impressive. Yeah.
It's cheap as well. It's like $30 for the whole thing. Like, usually, like, if you look at we'll talk about it in a bit, but like, if you look at Life is Strange, the new one, or even the Lost Records game from Dontnod, those were like $40, $50. So yeah, this is
They weren't like planning to like make a sequel when this came out. Like I'm sure they're planning to do it now. But since they're kind of working on maybe on a new thing for it, it's gonna be done from scratch. So it's gonna take a while for like. It's not gonna be like, hey, it's gonna come out next year. It's like, definitely not. These things take time and effort, and especially getting like the voice cast like schedules aligned again to like, you know, work on new voice acting for it. That will take time, because getting people's schedules aligned takes a really long time. People are busy. So it's one of those games that's been on my wish list when it came out, and I'll probably get around to it when, like, whenever the follow-up is maybe nearer. So maybe in a couple of years. But it's an interesting one. Like, I've heard really good things about it. Or definitely a lot of friends really enjoyed it. I think it's one of those games that maybe I'll get it to like maybe a year or two. We'll see.
I think the weekly release cadence, I don't want to say it was genius, but I think it was like a smart idea. And I kind of feel like the TV show comparisons and, you know, development pedigree kind of makes sense. Like the difference between like a weekly release show versus a show that's dropped all at once. And I know people have, you know, strong opinions one way or the other. I've always kind of fell in the weekly camp just because like it gives you more time to like, this is going to sound a little bit highbrow, but like critically think about what you're doing and like not just binge through it in like a TV show. And like there, it stays in the zeitgeist for a little bit longer. And for like, you know, we've seen other games with like episodic entries where people lose interest between episodes if there's like too much time between them. So the fact that if you were playing Dispatch as it released, you were never, you know, there's going to be a new drop in less than a week by the time you finish an episode. And then you finish an episode and there's a new drop in less than a week. So I think it just seems like it paid off for them.
It really depends. I've thought about this for a while. I guess for me, it really depends on the style of show that you're making or style of game. But because I'm usually a weekly person, definitely in that camp. But let's say like the Walking Dead TV series, they had a format which is like really, really did not service them in the weekly format because they had like, let's say, three different groups. So three different protagonists with three different, like, you know. Yeah, they were like had three different factions, and let's say Group A, Group B, and Group C. They had an episode format where it would advance the events of Group A, and then when that episode stopped, you wouldn't get back to Group A until like 3 weeks later because the next episode would be Group B, advancing. Then the next episode would be Group C advancing. So you wouldn't really be able to follow like. Get back to Group A's like storyline until like 3 weeks later, which really did not help it like in the weekly format. If you watched it in a marathon format, it would be way better because you would be able to get to Group A's events advancing faster. Because if you were following it weekly, you wouldn't be able to like get back to Group A's like current like state of events and interest until like 3 weeks later. You know, which really sucks.
No, that's a good example. No, I didn't think about that. I don't think I've watched a show quite like that, but that's a good example. So we do also have a few other features up on the site that were put up in the last week. This one, I'm going to hand it off over to Adam, where you had an interview opportunity with respect to the upcoming Dragon Quest VII Reimagined, of course, one of those early February releases that we're looking ahead at. So you had a chance to speak to Takashi Ichikawa, who, to my understanding, is like a relative newcomer. This is his first game with a producer credit. He's producer on Dragon Quest VII Reimagined. He's got credits on like games like Dragon Quest Treasures and Dragon Quest III HD 2D. But you had a chance to speak to him, and you were able to put up an interview feature with him. So, you know, what are some of the takeaways from your chance to get to talk to Mr. Ichikawa?
Yeah, so this isn't a very long interview because we had like very select slots that were available. They're doing like an interview like round with various outlets of which we were able to participate. He said to me that he was kind of an assistant producer on Dragon Quest Builders 2, as well as Dragon Quest 11S. But this is his like first game as main producer. And so he's been in like the Dragon Quest team for quite a while, but this is his kind of like first chance at like leading the production of a game. And I kind of asked him some questions that I think were, you know, kind of the more obvious, like, questions. Like, first of all, like, why are you releasing this game now? The HD 2D games of the Erdrick trilogy just came out. Like, that was not even 6 months ago, barely 3 months ago for 1 and 2 HD 2D.
1 and 2, yeah.
Yeah. And the answer to that was basically that they just wanted to keep the momentum going, which I'm not sure if I'm really satisfied with that answer, but sure. Why not? In terms of the visual style, I asked them directly, like, was this inspired by games like Fantasian? Which I thought would have been a fair question to ask, because Square Enix did publish the re-release of Fantasian, even though it's developed by Mistwalker. They refused to say what they were inspired by, but they basically said, like, Toriyama's art style for Dragon Quest VII specifically had always been a little bit more stylized with shorter characters. They actually literally use the word shorter characters, and they felt like the doll aesthetic, which they call handcrafted style, just fit the game better. And then they also said kind of vaguely, we saw that people like this sort of art style. Again, I'm not really, don't know if I'm satisfied with that answer either, I asked him about the story structure. I asked him about like adjustments made to the game in terms of the scenario structure and battles and things like that. It's kind of like how they build the game initially. They are trying to streamline it. I think they use the word streamline three different times in the interview. So that's definitely a goal. And I do think that is something to consider when playing through the game, is like, this is something that they explicitly are trying to do, is streamline it. Now, we'll see how that turns out in the end. Not just scenario stuff, but things like you can avoid battles because they're not random battles. If an enemy is much, much weaker than you, you can just skip the battle all entirely. You basically just defeat them on the field and things like that. I actually had a friend of mine who is a huge Dragon Quest fan tell me that they were mad at the interview. Not my question. They were mad at the answer of the very last question I asked. So the last question I asked was, basically summarizing it here, Reimagined makes a lot of changes that if you played the demo, you can see. Characters cannot like die. So in classic Dragon Quest games, a character dies, they literally become a coffin that follows you around and you have to revive them, right? That doesn't happen anymore. There are no individual inventories, which has been like in every single Dragon Quest game, I feel like. So that means you can have access to all your items all at once. The user interface is, of course, completely different from any other Dragon Quest game. And I basically asked him, can you describe why you made all of these just like functional changes to these classic Dragon Quest elements? And do you think you risk disappointing like Dragon Quest fans? And he basically said, we're trying to please everyone. And also, we talked to Yuji Horii. And that was kind of it. Like, okay.
Interesting answer.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think my friend, like I said, who's a long Dragon Quest fan, they were kind of like, not necessarily upset, but kind of like, why are we changing all this stuff now? Like, all these different elements in terms of battles, in terms of look, in terms of just classic, you know, features in Dragon Quest games. Yeah, I think they're probably looking for something more substantial than just, we're trying to please everyone.
And also our boss said it was okay.
Yeah.
Because like, they checked with Yuji Horii.
I just think that like all these changes they've made to the UI and stuff, but they still have the save system like similar to the old one where it has like an autosave, which the new games have. But to actually do a manual save, you still have to do it the same old way. And then the music, it still has the same old sound effects. So like, I don't get why they didn't like go all the way. Like they still were afraid to like make every single change and modernize every single aspect of it. And if he said that we wanted to do this to appeal to everyone, why not have a classic and modern like options in this? Or like just because I believe that in the demo, based on what people have been saying and based on what I've played, it's still quite easy even if you play around with the difficulty settings. So you're not going to be able to get a challenging experience right now unless something changes in the full game.
Yeah, but basically, I think the best takeaway from the interview is that you can kind of see like the philosophy about the approach to what they're trying to accomplish with this game. And they may succeed in what they're trying to do. It's whether or not you thought it was the right thing to do. So we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like whenever I think about this game, I just feel drained emotionally. I'm like, I just gotta play it for myself and find out, because the more ifs I think about, the more I get depressed. So I'm like, I'll just fucking play it. Who cares? Just fuck it.
Well, I think I haven't seen this often, but I have seen it sometimes where you know you write a review, which is, you know, always just a person's opinion, right? And people say, well, that's what they wanted, so how can you criticize that? It's like, well, like, it's almost beside the point, where it's just like, yeah, even if they succeed at something and your opinion on it is still negative, as long as you rationalize your opinion, you substantiate why you feel some way, like, then it's valid. It's kind of like, but it is good context to know that, you know, it wasn't, regardless of how Dragon Quest VII Reimagined turns out, like, it wasn't a mistake. These changes are deliberate. There's a philosophy behind it. And then, you know, you criticize it from that point of view. It doesn't mean you have to like it. You can still look at the like, Adam, you basically played two versions, or you played the most recent version of the game just like late last year, right? So you'll have a kind of a very recent point of view for comparing the two games together.
Yep.
About exactly to what extent they succeeded in their vision to that way. But
and it's also just like everyone has a different philosophy of what a remake should be, right?
Right.
So that's the thing. We're all different people, different perspectives, different angles of what a remake should and shouldn't be. And also, that gets muddied up on like modern expectations of like how do you appeal to like a modern audience as well, and when thinking about a remake of a game, and what is different boundaries of what is and isn't acceptable. Like if it's a remake, like go all in, or should you? Who knows? You know, it's such.
Well, we're gonna have a second verse of that discussion with Yakuza next month at the same time.
So. Oh yeah.
Yep. But Adam's interview with Ishikawa is up on the site at rpgsite.net. Then the last feature we have up here is Cullen and Mikhail both put up features related to Final Fantasy VII Remake making its way to Switch 2. Cullen, our resident, you know, Switch specialist, was able to talk about his time with the game in a pretty glowing fashion about saying that it feels right at home on Nintendo Switch 2. And then, Mikhail, you did a very thorough Final Fantasy VII Remake, you know, system comparison between PC, Steam Deck, and all the consoles. So what is your, like, not a new game, of course, but what is your main thesis now that Final Fantasy VII Remake is available on Switch 2 in addition to all the other places it's been released?
So I was reminded that the PC port is still really, really bad. It's not seen any improvement. Like, when it came to the Epic Game Store, it shipped with, like, textures and shadows, I believe, and it was just low and high, and one of them was like the PS4 setting and one of them was the PS5 setting, and I believe at that time the only advantage the PC version had over PS5 was you could run it at, like, if you had the hardware, you could do like 4K and 120. It didn't go above 120 from what I remember, but if you had that, it would do that. But then it had like a lot of Unreal Engine stutter issues which were never fixed. When I played it, on Steam Deck, and there was less stutter over there because, like, that's just how Valve and shaders and all that work. But it's a very bare-bones port, and, like, coming into this after Trails Beyond the Horizon is, like, getting punched in the face, honestly, on PC ports. So, PC port is still not great. I just, for some reason, I assume now that Rebirth, you know, like, Rebirth shipped with more options, maybe they'd go back and do it here, but no. Even with the patch which arrived day before yesterday, they just added the streamline progression. They didn't add anything else. So yeah, PC port still bad. I really like the Switch 2 version. Like, I thought it was just going to be like one of those things where people exaggerate how, like, it's a PS4 game after all, right? But this is really good looking on the Switch 2 handheld. Docked, I don't think I'd play it because, like, I have access to a PS5 and Series X where you get like much better visuals and like 60 FPS. But It's like one of the best looking Switch 2 handheld games I've played, like, by far. And it, because of DLSS and how that works, it looks better than the Steam Deck and ROG Ally as well. Because one more thing about the PC version, which I forgot to bring up earlier, is unless you mod it, it has forced dynamic resolution, which regardless of what's happening on the screen will just not look native. So if you're playing this without any PC mods, you're just getting a bad experience in general. So yeah, that was my takeaway from the PC version. I wasn't gonna like do this comparison without getting the PS4 version to compare the textures. And I did this funny headline like in the article, which was Final Fantasy VII Remake door comparison. And I literally like went to the same part of Cloud's, like, outside that apartment complex building thing. And I took a screenshot, I used the capture card to get the exact same, like, how the door looks, and it still looks like dog shit on PS4 Pro. But yeah, like, that's not a problem on Switch 2, so that was good to see. I had
completely forgotten about the whole door thing. It's all coming back to me, about that stupid indoor.
Yeah, like, I remember playing it on PS4, like, pre-release, and I was like, this game looks so nice, and then you get to some parts and the textures just don't load. And they never did. So, and you know what I did? I actually, because I had time and my PS4 Pro was in the other room, I literally stood outside the door and I left the console running for 2 hours and I went and did other stuff. And I was like, let me see if this is actually a texture streaming issue or it's something else. No, it still didn't load. So yeah.
Awesome.
And yeah, so that was Final Fantasy VII Remake did load times. It's just a very polished experience on Switch 2. And Xbox, if you've never played it on an Xbox Series X, easy recommendation. As usual, the, you know, like Play Anywhere, so you get the Windows Store version, and that was a big headache to test. Like, I actually spent more time with the Windows Store version than all the others combined, just because it took so long to download. Like, it took me, I measured it, it took me 7 times as long to download from the Windows Store as it did on Steam, on the same device, on the same Wi-Fi network. And yeah, the Windows Store version also takes longer to load and all. It's just like, you know, like Play Anywhere is good on paper, but it's almost never better than playing the Steam version. So yeah, that's another takeaway. And yeah, I've put numbers and a lot of images comparing handheld, PC handhelds, Switch 2 docked compared to PS5, Series X and all. So yeah, give it a read if you're curious and haven't played it yet. Because I specifically tested the integrate part as well, not just the demo portion. So yeah.
Did the integrated part still work as well? Because I almost forgot that was PS5 exclusive, right?
Yeah, so the integrated part holds up frame rate-wise well, but there are some textures where it's like I can't say in between PS4 and PS5 because there's no PS4 version of integrate, but there are some texture issues with the Switch 2 version, which are not there on PS5 and Xbox, which I'm a bit confused as to why this happened. I guess it's like a memory thing because the download size is the same across everything. It's like 90 point something. So this might be like a memory thing or what. But the one thing I can say is that the frame rate holds up well. And like, they should have done 40 FPS. Would have been nice to have. But if you're okay with 30 FPS, it does hold up well. It's definitely better than playing it on PS4 and PS4 Pro. So there's that.
Cool. So yeah, we have those two features up on the site. One from Colin and one from Mikhail, both about Final Fantasy VII Remake on Switch 2 and in Mikhail's case, every platform. So if you haven't played that yet and you're interested and not sure where to get it, check those out. With that, we'll go, I believe that's all the articles and features we had, so we'll go into the news section for this week. The biggest headlines this week came out of the Xbox Developer Direct. So two titles that we have covered up on the site, I believe these first two titles came from that showcase. The first one is a Xbox Microsoft published game. The second one is not, but was still kind of platformed at that showing. We finally got a detailed, I don't know if I should say detailed look, but a gameplay teaser for the long-awaited, long-listed Fable reboot from Playground Games. So this game has kind of been brought up in several fashions over the years because it was, you know, first announced quite a ways back. I'm going to look at our like history here. 2020. I was going to say like 3 years ago. No, 6 years ago, the Fable was first announced coming from Playground Games. So I actually did not watch this event live, but I did read the gameplay teaser and read through like their kind of like PR framed interview for like how Playground Games is approaching the title. Obviously, the original Fable games were from Lionhead Studios. This game is kind of like a reboot. It doesn't really have a direct chronological tie with the original trilogy. What they think makes a Fable game and what they tried to target with their new reboot. So underneath our, you know, our site post on the gameplay teaser is a pretty long Q&A kind of framed thing about their approach with Fable. But what do you guys think when you first saw this at the direct?
I think the first setting I'm going to turn off in that game is camera shake. the combat in
it seems like a very Josh statement, but yeah.
I mean, like I like the look of the combat, like the camera's like kind of zoomed out a little, but man, every impact hit with the weapon just shakes the camera like crazy, dude. I'm like, I kind of got a little nauseous watching the footage, to be honest. Like, man, this is a lot. But I can reliably trust Playground Games for including that option because they are a studio known for their accessibility options in their games, even won awards about it. So I think they're going in the right direction with this reboot. Very talented studio, very ambitious pivot to an action RPG. You know, gonna be the first one because they're known for their Forza Horizon games. The new Forza Horizon looks great. They are definitely trying to carry on the spirit of the Fable games with this new game. Very much, hey, you can kind of create whatever kind of character you desire and where their morals lie.
You start as a child because that's very, fable coded.
Yeah,
is that
for sure.
How, like, growing into the hero
or anti-hero you want to be
in. Yeah.
Your decisions will have ramifications. Like, if you purchase a property and dress all fancy, you'll have these rich traits on you. So when you approach someone in, like, frilly clothes and have a lot of money, they'll react accordingly to you. Very much Fable. They placed a very great emphasis on, like, hey, it'll be like 1,000 unique NPCs and the way that, like, you can start a life with them, can potentially get romantically involved with them. I'm like, that's very, I don't know, like, it should be very impressive, but there's something that's, like, kind of maybe rubs me the wrong way very faintly about it. It's like, that's like, I'm like, how do you get that to work? It seems very, 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 I don't know. It seems like overwhelming in a lot in some cases. Did you see that part of, like, the gameplay teaser?
I only watched the shorter, like, 3-minute teaser.
Okay, yeah, but they had, like, some portion of that
was, or like, not 3-minute, the 1-minute teaser, the very short one.
Yeah, they play some versions, like, hey, there's really, like, 1,000 unique NPCs that, like, you can kind of have very unique relationships with them.
I did see the thing about, they have 1,000 NPCs, none of them are, all handmade is the sales pitch.
Yeah I'm
looking through, like, this press release or whatever you want to call it, and the thing is, this feels like a conversation that comes up every year for the last 20 years, is they talk about, you can go anywhere and do anything, and they specifically say, like, well, I don't want to head a direction and realize I'm not a sufficient level to go there. So basically they're talking around, like, there's going to be scaling in some fashion, which is always kind of, we've seen it done very poorly in other games. Mm-hmm. Oblivion was a kind of a poster child for that. Obviously that was kind of in a conversation again last year with that remaster. And I'm interested in soliciting your guys' opinion. Like, I'm totally fine with, like, oh, this area is a high level, I should come back. Like, to me, that's, like, not like a, that's not a showstopper, but it seems like they're trying to avoid that. Like, I don't want anyone to feel like they're, like, I think the worst thing is, sort of, it doesn't matter which way you go, because everything's going to be on your level all the time. Like, I think it can be done correctly, but there's so many ways it can be done poorly, or it's a very hard thing to balance. And so many people engaging.
Somewhat related, I remember when Xenoblade Chronicles Cross Remaster came out last year, and I saw some people complaining, like, how am I supposed to travel when there's so many dangerous enemies? I'm like, that's why it's fun. You have to, like, know where places are safe and which places are not. I don't know.
Yeah, I like segmented roles. Like, I still think, like, the first Dragon's Dogma is still, like, a perfect, like, almost integration of that, because it didn't, like, specifically mark places. It's kind of, you knew where not to go because of experience. You saw trial and error in action. It's like, I got fucked over here. Let's go in another direction,
Well, I headed to the catacombs instead of the Undead Burg. I should go the other way.
Yeah.
It can be done okay. I want to say that. It's just that when I read that, I get more nervous than excited.
For sure.
Doesn't mean it can't be done right.
I'm very curious about this new Fable, especially, like, how much they're really placing it as, like, the world reacting to you. Like, one of the example cases that they had in the showcase was, like, hey, there's this giant that you can choose to kill or not early on. If you kill this giant early on, its corpse will always be there by this village, which can affect, like, living conditions there and the economy there, especially if you decide to become a landlord, in this game. Like, it'll affect prices there because of this giant's corpse, like, might have environmental ramifications later down the line. And, like, how much of that is going to be, like, really going to play into this game, or will it just feel scripted in a sense? Because I think one of the strengths of Fable is making things feel organic, even though, underneath the underneath everything, you know there's gears, but Fable was able to capture it in a way where, especially, like, when it came out at that time, it felt very novel. How do you have the spirit of Fable in today's landscape and not make it feel like that the gears are turning behind?
You know, I'm just curious, who here has played like the all of the original trilogy? Because I'm an outsider, I have not.
I've played the original trilogy. I don't like have like pitch perfect memory of them, but I played.
It was a while ago, yeah.
Yeah, I think the second one's probably your favorite. They're great games, you know. They showed an aspect of like Western RPGs in a way that no one could back then. Because you really did feel like, you know, it was your character. That's something that Lionhead really understood throughout those games. So I'm really curious, you know, I'm very, very excited for this game. Very, very
and the much looking forward to it. Key piece of news is that they did announce a window for release, that they're slating to release this in autumn. So, which is kind of interesting. I would have imagined this is like a holiday, like November release, but no, they've explicitly listed autumn. So, half a year, 6 months away. The other game that was platformed at the Xbox Developer Direct, which as I was preparing for this podcast, I watched it. I'm like, damn, I did not expect to be as interested in that as I was, is Beast of Reincarnation. Got a new pretty long look in and a new gameplay, a new kind of Developer Direct, 10-minute video kind of going behind the scenes of this. This is the open world action RPG from Game Freak, you know, Pokemon Studio. It was first shown at Xbox, I forget the name of it, the summer showcase or June showing last year. And we kind of said, huh, you know, it's always cool. You know, it's not the first time Game Freak has gone away from Pokemon. They've done that frequently throughout their history. But this is the most, you know, clearly the most recent time. And when I was watching this Developer Direct, I thought that it was just very, one thing I wasn't expecting is how open they were about, like, you know, as we developed Pokemon, they were, you know, refer to it, you know, very clearly in a video that has nothing to do with Nintendo.
They said Pocket Monsters a lot in that, and that is funny. Yeah.
Because they're, you know, this is a video uploaded by Fictions to their YouTube channel. Fictions is the publisher that used to be called Private Division. They were under Take-Two. I don't know if they're still affiliated with Take-Two. They're Fictions now. And I think Beast of Reincarnation is either their first or second title under, because they only changed name like late last year from Private Division to Fictions. But they mentioned, you know, we were inspired by Pokemon, or, you know, as I got approached by the producer and I knew I wanted to work on Beast of Reincarnation because I thought, you know, I was really driven by the vision of the project and just how open it was and how, like, yeah. Here I am kind of stammering. I thought it was a really interesting Developer Direct. If you have any, like, interest in game development at all, it's a 10-minute video, and I thought it was just, it made me kind of excited for this game, not only because, like, the game looks neat, which I think it does, but just because, like, it does feel like sort of the, here's a game the Game Freak really wants to make when they're not, like, in Pokemon, like,
corner. Interesting, like, look at, like, because when you see that a new Pokemon is announced and, like, being developed, you don't really see the people behind the scenes ever. When
that's very, develop, like, Nintendo, like,
yeah,
like, curated.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, this one actually gives, like, a face and a name to the people who are creating, like, one of the biggest media franchises on the planet, you know? Which is like that was really cool. It's like, hey, these are the people at Game Freak who actually do develop the Pokemon games. They're now doing completely something new, but using the lessons they've learned from Pokemon and applying it to, like, a completely new type of game that, you know, they want to make and are energetic to, like, explore and develop out. That's really fucking cool. Like, that this was a really, really great showcase.
One other thing is, I believe it was an IGN interview had a chance to talk with the team for Beast of Reincarnation. They also mentioned that Game Freak is, like, leading the development, but it's actually a smaller team, and that there's a lot of, like, external studios also helping. So I just wanted to mention that it's not just Game Freak, even though they are, like, in charge of it.
And they also kind of, it's similar to Fable, they narrowed down a release window at the very end of the showcase that they're aiming for a summer release, so not too far away for Beast of Reincarnation. So I will say, just as I watched this kind of did shoot up on my, like, when I was first shown off last year, I was like, oh, Game Freak's working on something different, neat. And now I'm kind of like, oh, Beast of Reincarnation this summer, I'm probably gonna play that. Like, I'm kind of excited for it now, so I'm interested to see how you know what they've got here. And then the last big announcement here, Mikhail kind of teased it or alluded to it ahead of time, is the announcement of Life is Strange Reunion. Now, I'm not the authority to talk about this because I've never played a Life is Strange game, but the big sale point here is that it's Max and Chloe playable together in a Life is Strange game for, I guess, the first time. I thought they were both playable in the original game, but maybe I'm misinformed.
They're trying to like say, oh, we're going to give them the definitive or the ending you wanted or some weird ass marketing thing like that, which is kind of annoying because for a lot of people, go ahead.
I was thinking like Yakuza Kiwami, where people can't stay dead and they're just like unhappy with
dead. Continue, Miguel.
So with Life is Strange, what happened is the developers have changed. Like, it's been Dontnod and Deck Nine, and they've had some games which one has made, some games where the other has made. For a lot of people, they like Life is Strange 1, like just Life is Strange. They like Life is Strange 2, which again was Dontnod, but I don't know what's happened with the sales or what's caused Square Enix to like do different developers or like try these other things. But for a lot of people, like Life is Strange 2, and then Lost Records, Bloom and Rage, which was Dontnod published, they like those three of them. But then there are others who like Life is Strange Before the Storm, which was the game which came out after the original, which I like that as well. Since then, what they've been doing has been hit or miss or whatever. People don't like the characterization or whatever. The latest one before the new one which got announced was Double Exposure. That has like the most people annoyed with what they've done because Max's character, the model has changed. I thought it was okay. I didn't think it was like awful and stuff like that, but it's evident that like they don't know what they're doing with the IP anymore, and they're just releasing it because they have Life is Strange games. Like, it's not hit the highs of, I'd say, even the first two games they released. So with Reunion, them trying to do this is like, oh, we're finally, like, you've been saying you want this, so we're going to give it to you. And that I don't like. I don't want games like that. I want you to tell me your story. Don't tell me what I want, and don't give me what I want. So that's my read on this situation where I'm just like, I don't know what to expect from this. At worst, I think I'll at least get some good music recommendations because those never let me down in the Life is Strange games. But I have no real hope for the actual story anymore because, like, I mean, anyone who's played the original Life is Strange and enjoyed it, you should not want this. Like, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I've seen a few editorials go up after the announcement, you know, discussing this general idea, like the by fans, for fans, like headline marketing. Even in the press release, even on the blog post on Xbox Wire, is very, like, it's not a great sales pitch.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, it's a similar or related argument to what you talked about with the Dragon Quest thing. Like, we're trying to please the fans. Like, we're trying to please people. It's like, you have to do that to some extent, but also you should have, like, a vision for the story you want to tell and the characters you want to make, not just what's going to make the most fans happy all the time, like, because that's, like, an impossible vision in a lot of ways. So, at least in my opinion. And that is releasing relatively soon. It is, let me scroll up, March 26th for Xbox, PS5, and PC. And there's also, Mikhail mentioned Double Exposure. I guess there's a bundle. Since Double Exposure was only last year, right?
2024.
Okay, so 2 years ago. So we have written down that the Life is Strange Reunion is $40, but there will also be a deluxe there'll also be a bundle for $60 with Double Exposure and Reunion.
No Final Fantasy costumes this time. They did that for Double Exposure in the deluxe edition, if I remember correctly. And what is the Final Fantasy 37 or something? I forgot which one that was in.
Final Fantasy 27 comes out next year, according to Deus Ex Human Revolution. So I made a joke on Blue Sky, like, we are going to get so many Final Fantasy games in the next 12 months. Like, we're, you know, 10 games behind. We're going to get, like, 9 games this year.
Can it start with 27?
Deus Ex Human Revolution takes place in 2027.
Oh, okay.
So, like, in that universe, we have, like, 10 Final Fantasy games we need to get to make it a reality.
Well, I mean, if the spin-offs count, maybe. Hmm.
Also, on Life is Strange, as far as I understand, Life is Strange True Colors, which came out like a handful of years ago, is maybe not like considered like fantastic, but generally well liked and had nothing to do with like the Max or Chloe thing, as far as I know. So the fact that they keep kind of going back to that well also kind of feels like unoriginal in a way.
People don't like the original new look for
there was Before the Storm. Then there was Life is Strange 2, which is also like a separate story with new characters. Then True Colors was 2021. And this is me just kind of reminding myself. And then, yeah, it feels like 2024, Double Exposure, they really kind of started going back to Max and Chloe, like what kind of put Life is Strange on the map. And now Reunion feels like doubling down on that. But I'm an outsider. I've not played any of these. So that's just me. That's just me reading off of Wikipedia. A few other trailers and announcements that have come up over the last week. Nioh 3, the other game releasing in early February, just released a long 17-minute like gameplay showcase that I watched through before the podcast. As I watched through it, it wasn't really anything like new in terms of like something we weren't expecting in general, except for the fact like new monsters, new characters, you know, a fair bit of combat footage for like seeing like, oh, they're using the scythe in this game. And then if you wanted to like compare it to how the scythe worked in Nioh 2 and compare the combos and the stances, or it does kind of, I don't know if spoil is too strong a word, but it shows like, you know, some unique boss designs, things like that. It almost feels like a trailer made out of, like, it almost feels like B-roll, but I'm not really complaining because it's just kind of like, you want to see what the game looks like and plays like. Here it is, with a little bit of talk about like the open.
Sorry. I just think it's a little bit of a funny like gameplay video because like, it did its best to not show any menus or UI or anything like that. It just,
well, I was going to get to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. My bad.
No worries. Like I almost feel like whenever I see a game that doesn't show UI, like I don't want to be a broken record. Like, oh, RPG Fest complaining that they're not showing UI again. But like, I was actually going to bring up, like, obviously they talk about it's an open world, but they don't show any, like, I don't think they show any map or any progression or anything like, what does this look like as you're progressing through the game? They speak to it. They say like you are clearing crucibles in the regions and the timelines, but they don't show like how does a player do that. Like, it's all like, if there was no commentary, this could have been any other Nioh game with a conventional like level based system. They don't really show like the open world progression.
Yeah, so I previewed this game last year, right? And I think when you play Nioh 3, based on my time with it, that's this. Like the world structure and like the region leveling up. We talked about it, how it like has like that Rise of the Ronin kind of influence from it. That's like very obviously the what's new and different here. Like, that's in your face. It's there. It's unavoidable, and it's probably going to dictate how much you like this game compared to the others, because that's what sets it apart. So the fact that they kind of avoided showing that or talking about it or very loosely talking about it is kind of like, I don't know. It's like, that's the key decision you made in making this game.
I will say that, not really related to that, but there's an area where they show some platforming and I was like, wait a minute, could you jump in Nioh 2? Google, can you jump in Nioh 2? No, you couldn't.
Yeah. So yeah. They added it.
Jumping.
Yeah. That's the biggest change of this game. It's not the open roll open zone explosion, it's the jump.
You can jump. Yep. That's why Elden Ring was so well received. Yep. But it definitely does look like a Nioh game, but yeah, it does come back to like, how does that open world progression feel? Feel good, or am I just gonna wish it was, you know, more like Nioh 2?
It's either gonna be
I gotta admit that I'm a bit worried after like going through Rise of the Ronin. It's like, ooh, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I think me and you played Rise of the Ronin about the same time. Like, Adam watched me play a good chunk of it, and then I saw that you were on Blue Sky talking about it. And yeah, the open world bar didn't really, I wasn't sold on it. And yeah, here's a chance to iterate and maybe do it a little better, but I'm not excited for it.
I feel like this game has like a really weird like pendulum swing. It's like, it's either going to be either a really, really very disappointing Nioh game, or it's going to be one of the best action RPGs this year. And there's no in-between. It feels like.
Yeah, I guess the only in-between are going to be like, In the whatever ways you can ignore the open world, if possible, like in the parts where if they're like, you know, Legacy Dungeon or whatever the equivalent is, maybe that's the Crucibles. Like, in those little vertical slices are great because they're classic, the right word. They're conventional Nioh, but everything else, we'll see if they stick the landing for that progression. Here's one that you added to the podcast that I can't really speak to. It's a dungeon crawler RPG that was recently announced. Demon Kill Demon Yomi 1984, related in some way to the 2020-2021 game Undernaut's Labyrinth of Yomi. So what is Demon Kill Demon Yomi 1984?
That's the next game coming from Experience. So far, it's only announced for Switch in Japan, coming on May 28th. I can't really speak to like how it's related to Undernauts, but it does look really freaking cool. James and Adam, you have more insight into it.
I think when they say these games are like related, it almost doesn't matter. Like they swear that like all their games are like in the same universe. You know, Stranger of Sword City and Undernauts and that other one whose name I forget that was bundled with Stranger of Sword City.
Savior of Sapphire Wings.
Like they're all technically in the same universe, but it's so loose it practically might as well not be.
Yeah. I will say that I'm excited for this because the gameplay, like the core gameplay loop and like the combat of Undernauts is really, really good.
Yeah, it's one of the best ones.
I do think that it's a little disappointing that it doesn't seem like it's using the same artist as Undernauts, because that was absolutely that game's like strongest appeal, was just how fucking beautiful the 2D artwork was.
Remember when they did Stranger of Sword City, and then in one of the re-releases, they added like the anime option?
God, yeah, that's it's not quite that like bad, but I am getting the vibe. I am getting the vibe.
I'm still kind of salty with what they did with what was it, Radiant Historia, the remake of that remaster. Oh, yeah. Where
was that the one where you had to buy the old portraits as DLC?
Yeah, that was fucked up. They're like the new portraits are like, it's okay. I personally don't like it as much as the old one. They're like, oh, here's the old one for you can just pay money for it for DLC. I'm like, that was definitely one of Atlas's lowest points amid an ocean of low points in monetization.
A couple other updates. Here's another, another upcoming game related topic. Code Vein 2, of course, is not even a February game. That's an end of January game. That's less than a week away. They did release a character creator demo for this game, which, if I remember right, Code Vein 1 did the same thing. Did it? Am I misremembering that?
I
think Dragon's Dogma had
but,
one.
Games have done it. It seems like a pretty fun way for a demo. I've not played Code Vein 1, so when I saw that Code Vein 2 had a character creator demo, I was like, oh, that's neat. People are going to share, like, making... I've already seen, like, people make the, the James Cameron Avatar aliens or different, like, anime characters or things like that.
I've seen, like, Made in Abyss character, like the one that wears the crazy helmet. I saw Zero from Code Geass. People are mimicking some Toho characters. Okay. This is a crazy find that I shared in staff chat earlier today, but one of the things I found out was, Kenji Anobuki, the director of Scarlet Nexus. So he shared that he recreated Yuito from Scarlet Nexus in the Code Vein 2 character creator demo. I'm like, that's cool. He's still rocking it. And even Adam mentioned, like, man, he saw his at Scarlet Nexus in his Twitter handle. That's how he's still a trooper. I'm like, and I remember Anobuki. It used to do like one Scarlet Nexus screenshot a day thing, and that got into the hundreds. And I'm like, oh man, like he really like, I thought he stopped doing that years ago. I thought at a certain point he went on to his next project, and it was like he did some work on the Tales of Arise story DLC thing that they did. It's like, oh, okay, he's like done, right? And then apparently, this man has never stopped doing that one Scarlet Nexus screenshot a day thing on his personal social media. He's like on day 1,871. I'm like, there is no bigger fan of Scarlet Nexus than the director of it, and you will never take that away from him. And I think that's a beautiful thing that he's the biggest fan of his like work, and like that's he believes, and I support him 100%. To be honest, that's like such an amazing thing.
I take this as evidence that Scarlet Nexus 2 is still being worked on. We have to go. We have to go to the moon.
We must go to the moon.
That's what they tease at the end of the game. The moon is where all the answers are.
That's just real life right there. We must go to the moon.
The other two comments that I saw on the Code Vein 2 character creator is like, A, I guess the character creator demo is like 25 gigs, which is either equal to or almost as big as like the whole original game. It's like, why is this character creator 25 gigs?
It just did you see those PC spec requirements?
I guess I didn't for the creator.
Well, just for the game, Code Vein had pretty high requirements.
Oh, that one.
Seemed kind of, Code Vein 2 seemed kind of like, why is it so high?
And then the only
Unreal Engine saw, 5.
Yeah, probably.
Like, I saw the reception on Steam was like negative. And some people say like it's censored or whatever, but some people just said like it just doesn't feel like there's as many options as there used to be. Like there's like the variety of characters are not there, or they couldn't quite get as much fidelity as they could on the previous character creator. So I don't have enough like direct insight to like have the comparison, but I was surprised to see that. Like, oh, some people really think this character creator is like limited.
I mean, I can kind of see like using the term censorship aside, which, you know, isn't really like the proper term, but I do understand like kind of the disappointment from some people who really dig the first game's character creator. And like, you know, some of the options in there was like, hey, some of the clothing options had panties on the characters, and panties are like a totally normal thing that, you know, real people were wear. And now this game like has some either identical or like the same options, but they wear spats instead of panties. You know, it's like, and like some people do like like having that option as part of their fashion design for their characters, and like, because that's a totally normal, you know, thing to wear. I'm like, I get it, you know. And using censorship for that, maybe not the proper term, but, you know, I kind of get that same, I understand where the disappointment is coming from that, like, artistic sense.
No, I get that. I was trying to interpret some of the review comments without knowing specifically what they're referring to, because a lot of the language is very...
Oh, yeah, I get, yeah, absolutely, I get so, that. Yeah, some people are very hyperbolic and, like, stupid about the way they verbalize shit like that.
Yeah, so, like, yeah, it was very, very charged language, but even between the charged language, there are people just saying, like, they can't get the characters, like, they can't even get the character that they had in the first game. Like, they can't even, the number of options are less, or they're not
that
as
makes
good,
sense.
Or the fidelity is worse. So, mm-hmm. All up and down the spectrum, it seems like the reception's been kind of a bit muted on the character creator. So, interesting, like, I wasn't expecting to see that, so I was just kind of making a note.
Speaking of, you know, not so great reception to demos of unreleased games, Brian.
This one I actually don't know about. I'll need you to team me up. I've read a lot about the upcoming Yakuza Kiwami 3 and Dark Ties, you know, leaks and other things. And of course, that game is coming out relatively soon. But I don't know specifically about the demo. So what are you teeing me up here for?
So, yeah, the demo for Yakuza Kiwami 3 and Dark Ties came out. And people are kind of not jazzed about it for a number of reasons. One, it does have like that weird auto exposure from Pirates Yakuza in Hawaii, where some darker areas, like if you're traveling down a hallway or a street that's like in the shadow of a building, it feels weirdly brightened up because the game is trying to do auto exposure lighting for it. So there are definitely some parts, especially some screenshots floating around, where the game looks way too bright for what the environment is. And that looks like it kind of looks like a fake video game in that aspect. In some of those screenshots, because of the weird auto exposure thing that it tried to do in Pirates Yakuza in Hawaii. I forgot if the man who erased his name did this as well. I don't know. But definitely really you could tell in Pirates of Yakuza.
Are you talking about like the effect, like when you go from an interior location to an exterior location, like it blooms up quite bright and then dims out? Is that what you mean?
So yeah, but like,
just
but even does
it poorly.
But even though it does this like in outwards environment, even beyond that, like, you know, that transition from leaving a building to outside. But yes, so there's definitely some weird screenshots. Like, it does. There's also from like this demo is from, you know, an old version of that build, an old build of that game. So who knows how the final game, if it'll fix that or not, but. You know, that doesn't feel great. Some people criticize kind of the combat of it, where it kind of feels like Kiryu is too magnetized to enemies in the way that he's doing his combo strings, and the way that, you know, there's some battle animations that feel like they don't transition properly from another. So the combat itself kind of looks a little bit jank, just from like both feel of it. And look of it, it feels off. Like I said, this from a old build of the game, so I don't know if that's, you know, straightened out in the final release or not. But that doesn't make a great impression. Even like the new combat styles and Mine's Dark Ties gameplay, like, people, I don't know, they aren't really feeling, you know, it. And let me tell you, there's no way to say like this is like the worst of it. Like, Kiwami 2. Kurami 2's combat felt ass. Let's be honest, it did not feel good. So I kind of get it.
I remember at the time, if I remember my timeline right, mm-hmm. a lot of it was kind of either attributed or partially attributed to it was a new engine. Right. It was either first or second game of the new engine, and like I do remember the comments about it not feeling like as good as like Kiwami 1, which was on the classic engine.
Right. Yeah, I think there's like some new gameplay systems behind the scenes here, where like they did some stuff with the game, like the gameplay feel to kind of make it feel different. But I don't know.
They added some of the pirate Yakuza mechanics, like you know the bug catching stuff, and I was like, why?
yeah.
Okay, yeah. Kiwami 2.
I don't know if that's even accessible.
Dragon Engine after 6. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry, I was reminding myself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think everyone played Kiwami 2 on PS4 because like it wasn't like PC at that time until much later, and it was like pushing PS4 quite a bit. Like I obviously, like when I played Kiwami 2 originally, I tolerated it and stuff, and I played it on base PS4, I think. So like now when I was like revisiting it on PS4 Pro for an article, I was like, how did I tolerate this back then? But yeah, that's just how these things go. But yeah, in addition to what Josh said, the visuals, it's like everyone's like fixated on that one comparison screenshot because the lighting is like completely broken and dog shit in that one area. So it looks like you're going from a game which is like decent baked lighting to a game where the lighting doesn't load. So it literally feels like you're playing an Unreal Engine 5 game with no lighting at all. So there are no shadows, nothing, no reflections or anything. But the rest of the game, I'm not justifying what they did, but the rest of the game just kind of looks like Infinite Wealth and Pirate Yakuza in Hawaii. So it has all those faults, but it doesn't look worse than those games, at least according to me, based on what I've played. Yeah. It's just this one part looks really bad, and I'm just confused as to why I haven't played the Dark Tides or Dark Ties thing yet. I just wanted to check out how karaoke was in this and just play this. But I'll say one thing though, like you know the shinies on the ground in Yakuza 3, like Kiryu takes like 45 minutes to bend over and pick up something. Over here, it's instant. Now I'm happy about that. Like, that's the only good thing I can say right now. Like, in that sense, I like what they've done. But I don't know, like, the demo is a very... There's also, like, you know how Josh said, this is an early build, so we don't know what the final game... There's, like, cutscenes which they've removed from the demo, which are already there in gameplay videos. So I'm not sure what the point was of releasing a demo, which is not even a representation of that opening moment of the game properly. So, like... This demo, I feel like, is doing more harm than good for them, just based on the reactions online.
I won't really get into it. There's been some, you know, murmurs and some talk that, you know, the people who data mined the demo, like, apparently, you know, supposedly the ending of Kiwami 3 and Dark Tides are in there in some fashion, whether it's like the, like dialogue or maybe even cutscenes, depending on how, you know, how people have thoroughly data mined it. And, you know, from all the rumors that have, like, been circling around, like, you know, based on, like, what people found in the data mines. If this is actually true, I'm very curious to see where people land on it. If all the things that have been revealed supposedly about the endings of both Kiwami 3 and Dark Tides is true, if so, you know, I'll have more to say about it if I see it for myself, play through it myself, and find out. Like this.
So I have a question for you based on this. Obviously, without getting into the spoilers, you played Yakuza 2 and you've played Kiwami 2 and you don't like Kiwami 2. So do you think what you've read about Yakuza Kiwami 3 is as much of a like change compared to what they did with Kiwami 2, or is it like
if this is true? If this is true what they did based on, you know, on these things, I think this is easily worse than what they did to Kiwami 2. Easily. By a mile.
You guys already talked about last week the original game only being available in like the big giant bundle.
Yes, yeah. Okay. I actually provided a screenshot in the voice channel chat when we described it, where I don't have 3, 4, and 5 remastered on my Steam. So I was like, well, okay, let me go click add to cart on this. What will it look like? And I have no way to purchase that complete bundle because I already own Yakuza 0, 1, and Kiwami 1 and Kiwami 2. From that bundle, so there's no way for me to actually purchase that bundle because I own those. So if I If Yakuza 3 Remastered gets delisted and I can only buy it from that complete bundle, that means I effectively cannot buy buy Yakuza 3 Remastered at all, because I already have some of those things from that bundle, so I can't purchase that bundle because I don't.
I found the SteamDB entry where they changed the bundle type in, like, they've changed the bundle type twice and restricted gifting and stuff. I'm posting it in the staff chat because they did this around the time when they replaced Yakuza 0 with Director's Cut. And the last change is 19 days ago as of this recording, which would be 5th Jan, which I think is before they announced this change. But the bundle type was changed 19 days ago to purchase as set. So, yeah, that I believe.
That is a very deliberate decision. It's not an accident. Ay, ay, ay. Yeah, this is...
So basically, it feels like they're trying to thread the needle of they don't want people to actually buy or play the original Yakuza 3.
10 million percent.
Yeah.
They're like, it's kind of like speaking out of both sides of their mouth. They're like, it's technically available under, like, A, a whole series bundle, that B, that is unavailable to people who already own an entry or two on the bundle.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And how many people own Yakuza 0, like, alone on PC? It's like,
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. That won't affect this, though, because they removed that and replaced it with Director's Cut. So you can, I think people who have 0 can still buy this now, but I'm not sure because I own all the games on Steam.
But now I have Kiwami 1 and Kiwami 2 Legacy. Both of them are under Legacy. I'd have to pay $2 to get them to the new versions of them.
I wonder. I guess one thing you can do, which you shouldn't fucking have to, is you can ask Steam to remove those games.
Yeah, you can. Yeah,
insane. Amazing. This is
And this is a company that has been on Steam and released, like, Japanese games before many of the other big publishers, knows the importance of, like, reviews, knows the importance of how that affects your search on the algorithm and stuff. And they delisted the pages for, like, Yakuza 0, Kiwami, and Kiwami 2. Yakuza 0 probably had more reviews than, like, many of their Total War games. But, yeah, that's what they're doing.
But the thing is I'm sure that whoever was in charge of this decision wasn't in charge of those decisions like a decade ago. I guarantee it.
I can see.
So I was just trying to remind myself. I think we already talked about this, but I was just reminding myself, like, yeah, Yakuza 0's Steam page is still there, thankfully. So it's like, wow, Yakuza 0, overwhelmingly positive with 50,000 reviews. Yakuza 0 Director's Cut, mixed, 700 reviews.
You can't access the Yakuza 0 page on Steam unless you get the link directly. So if you search for it on Steam, it doesn't show up, I believe. But if it's cached on SteamDB and on Google search, and if you have the direct link, it'll still work. But you can't actually search for it as far as I know. I don't know why they didn't just do what Bioshock did, where they added the remaster as an app to the original. Or, like, if you buy it, give you both and, like, you know, keep a bundle. But they've just made it somehow worse than what the Outer Worlds did, where, like, I still don't know.
What did System Shock do? Isn't System Shock
System Shock you buy, you, 2 you buy the 25th System Shock 2 removed the standalone and... Yeah, they removed the original cheaper non-remaster version and made it so that you can only get that if you buy the remaster, which costs more. So you still get both together, still, and the page is visible. You buy the
remaster, yeah. And inside of that executable, you can play the 1999
version. No, you just get both apps added to your Steam account buy it.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not like what Bethesda did. What you're saying is something Bethesda does with the Doom and Quake and not Wolfenstein, Doom, Quake, and Heretic and Hexen. What they did is, if you own the original, they updated it to now have on Steam, it asks you, do you want to play classic or do you want to play remaster? So, like, that again would have been a nice solution, but Sega's like, no, we delist the old one. That's it.
The Yakuza series and Persona series are just both classic examples of you became too important at work, so you're not a tentpole franchise, so you will be treated like one, but for better and for worse.
Most of the rest of the headlines for this week are pretty quick, so we'll kind of rattle right through them. This one I think we kind of all saw coming based on the communication from last year, but New World Aeternum is going to be shutting down its servers on January 31st of next year. So, and it's delisted, I believe, as of now. So, like, you can continue to play it if you own it for one more year. Kind of sad because it always felt like it was moderately successful, but clearly not to the level that Amazon wanted, needed it to be.
At least they're giving people quite a bit of a heads up, like, in advance, you know? That's good. Good on them on that.
At least their communication's been clear, but it still sucks.
It's still, you know, it's still kind of, you know, baffling because there's still, like, ancient MMOs still running to this day. But, you know, the Amazon wants to see the big bucks, and if you're not doing that...
I guarantee it's not even so much that the game hasn't been successful or it's even still successful. It's that they want to use that infrastructure for AI data centers.
Oh, man, I didn't think about that.
That's even more messed up.
I don't like that. I don't like that you said that and you're like, oh, fuck, I didn't think of that.
The worst part is that you know that's probably pretty likely to be, like, a big part of that calculus.
You're not wrong. You definitely are wrong.
One quick sales update. Tainted Grail, The Fall of Avalon has hit 1 million sales across all platforms.
Cool.
Yeah. A couple dates. This one I thought was interesting. I saw Mikhail mention it in our chat here. Final Fantasy II is coming to Game Pass on February 3rd. Why is it specifically Final Fantasy II?
One is already in there. One is already in there, and I think they're just gonna like do them as like roll split through, up into six different Game Pass drops so that they can pad out how it looks on when they say we're adding new games to the service.
That's funny.
but this also this also probably like gives people, I don't know how many people are gonna do it, but it gives people time to like play them, and then you can play two next and. I don't know. Let's see if they do six, I'll be like, that's the one which I assume a lot of people want out of these. It's not my favorite of the six, but that's the most popular one. So I want to see if they actually do that or they stop at like five or something. But yeah, they've just started like with one. They started before. Now there's two. Let's see if February has three. So yeah,
I want to hear from the person who is subbing to Game Pass just for Final Fantasy II. I want to hear from them. I want to know them. Like, hey, is this finally the thing that got you to finally subscribe to Game Pass? Final Fantasy II?
It's a saga game in all but name, so I get it. Warframe is launching for Android on February 18th. So, I wasn't expecting that, but there you go.
I have a question.
I'll do a Night of this.
The child's getting to where I'm at, but why not iOS and only Android?
It's been out on iOS for a while. That's why
I had no idea.
And the iOS version is like fantastic. It's like better than playing the Switch version on Switch 2 even now. And they added like it launched, it was a little like, you know, they did a port, it ran and it looked fine, but it was like a bit bare bones and all, but then they like patched it so much and like it became amazing. So they even did like proper touch controls if you want to play the whole game with touch, or you can attach a controller and all. And for Android, they said there's so many different devices, we want to make sure we do it right. So they partnered with someone and they did closed tests and they did like these whatever like alpha, and then they finally like are getting to a point where they want to release it.
Nice.
Yeah, so they said with the Android version now it'll be playable on every current platform in some form. And then they said the native Switch 2 version is coming later in Q1 2026. They'll announce the date, I believe, next month. So it's probably going to be before end of March. But yeah, the Android version is the big news because you can already play the Switch version on Switch 2. Doesn't look as good as it should, but it's still playable. But Android was like their last player base, last audience which they couldn't reach. So they're addressing that, and they are doing another big update in March as well. So like, they're like firing on all cylinders since the last few years.
How does this make you feel as a fellow Do It Night Abyss player?
I won't quit. They got a lot of catching up to do.
How do you feel as like as someone who's trying to be somewhat in the I guess saying Warframe competitor to Do It Night Abyss is like, not, they're not even the same universe at this point, but it's just It's just like, man, what are we doing? Oh, do it, Night Abyss. We need to stop fighting about this game here. We do it too much.
Here's one that I guess I shouldn't be surprised by, but I did see the headline like, oh, that's finally happening. Greedfall 2, The Dying World. Huh, I noticed that it...
They got rid of the 2.
I was going to say, like, is this an older box art? Like,
that's okay, so funny.
Yeah, so, okay, well, to get an art, we must have, like, the early access box art on our CMS. Because, yeah, I didn't realize they dropped the 2. But, okay, Greedfall, The Dying World. Previously, Greedfall 2, The Dying World. Released in early access late in 2024. It was a game that I was kind of interested in because I thought the first game was like promising, had an interesting concept potential, rough around the edges, could really be improved upon a sequel, all that sort of thing. And then they decided to go the early access route. They changed publishers from Focus Entertainment to Nacon, however you pronounce that French one.
But to be clear, they didn't just change publishers. Nacon bought them or owned them now.
Spiders. Okay. I forgot yes. About that. So yeah, so same developer. Previously, Greedfall was published by Focus Home, and now it's Nason. They released an early access. From what I could tell, the early access release was pretty, like, not well-received, primarily due to changes with, like, the way combat worked, where Greedfall's combat wasn't, like, the reason I thought it was interesting, but it was a pretty typical, like, over-the-shoulder third-person action RPG, where Greedfall 2, or previously, formerly known as Greedfall 2, is more of, like, a Dragon Age Origins kind of top view real time with pause, which can work well, but apparently just like wasn't working well, you know, in the early access period. They've announced that it's releasing in full release, like version 1.0, on March 10th for PC, and then a couple days later for the consoles, like March 10th for PC, March 12th for PS5 and Xbox Series, and then March 19th for PS5 in Japan. So kind of a staggered release across platforms and regions. Along with the release date announcement, they did give a little bit of a gameplay overview. And the first half of the overview is like, I'm nodding along, where it's just like, okay, they're setting it slightly differently. Instead of being in like a new world and you're kind of in like the European like analog role, that you're playing as a native of Tir4D and you're brought over to, you know, your conquerors, and you have to go from that perspective. Like, oh, that's interesting from its face. But then they go into the gameplay, and I kind of like, oh, that is very different from what I'm expecting from this, because I never played the early access. So I'm interested in this just to see, like, what did they come up with here? Like, but I can kind of see, like, maybe why the reception was what it was when it came to early access on this, because.
Yeah. You want to know something funny? I was also interested. It's like, hey, how are people feeling about this game? So, yeah, when you go to the Steam forums for this game, it still says Greedfall 2: The Dying World in the Steam forums. I wonder if that can be changed or not. That's funny.
So I guess they're really kind of positioning it as like a side story or spinoff or something. I don't quite know. It's an interesting decision. But yeah, I'm going to definitely play this, but almost like, I hope it's at least as good as the first game. Like, because the first game was pretty all right. So
I want to know why they changed the name. Why did they take off the 2 in the name? That's actually what I really want to know.
I think they had a Steam post about this, and I believe it mostly came down to the fact that it was like, it's Greedfall 2, but it's a prequel. Like, it takes place before Greedfall, and that was confusing. So no longer Greedfall 2.
What about Dragon Quest 3?
You know, Aura.
That's different.
Bat and Kaitos 2.
Uh-huh. Yeah, true.
They did change that in the West. They're like, we can't call it Bat and Kaitos 2 in the West. That's confusing to Western brain.
Yeah.
Oh, was Origins a Western? Like,
yes, because that game is called Bat and Kaitos 2 in Japan.
Oh. I didn't know that. So maybe Greedfall will be called Greedfall 2 still in Japan when it releases. Seven Deadly Sins Origins was supposed to release on January 28th. It's getting pushed back to March. We don't even know when in March, just in March.
I think we vaguely talked about that, but it's just formalized as a news post.
And then we also got a release window for Aether and Iron. This is a narrative RPG that, Josh, you were able to go hands-on for PAX West, I believe.
Or yeah, maybe I, pretty extensive. Like, I wrote a preview for it. And, mm-hmm. or, don't know if it was a preview or and or I think it was just the interview with a little mini preview on it, but it was a pretty extensive interview with a with a narrative designer on it, and I'm looking forward to it. Like, it's a pretty ambitious game. Like, they aim for it to be fully voice acted, and it's like and its presentation is very Disco Elysium esque. You know, it's definitely it's not shy about where its inspiration is, but I got very curious about it because of the way that they are kind of they've designed this like retro futuristic New York. So it's like it's still like 1930s New York, but has like futuristic technology on it, and you play as a detective. So it's pretty neat. I'll definitely play it.
So they announced that it's going to be releasing in spring, but as far as I can tell, Mikhail, like this is the trailer attached to the announcement on our site is an old trailer because the announcement didn't have any accompanying media other than
that's correct.
It's coming out.
That's the trailer which they had in the. Yeah, that's the trailer they had in the announcement in the email, and it's the old trailer.
All right, and that's all the headlines we have. So I'm looking at the calendar. Next week will be the last, already 1 month down in 2026. I guess we're not going to be talking about Seven Deadly Sins because that won't be out by next week. I don't know if we'd actually talk about
it. Maybe Code Vein.
Yeah, okay, we'll see on that one. So we'll be recording the day after Code Vein comes out. So we might have an opportunity, but it depends if we're in a place to be ready to talk about that. So next week, potentially Code Vein. Week after is when everything starts, you know, Dragon Quest, Neo, all the things you talked about. Yakuza Kiwami the week after that. So looks like a pretty regular cadence for next couple weeks for the TetraCast topics. But we do have just one final run through. We do have Chao's Ark Knights Enfield review up on site, rpgsite.net. Adam's chance to speak to Dragon Quest VII Reimagined producer Takashi Ichikawa up on the site. A couple features for Final Fantasy VII Remake as it got released on Switch 2. Of course, all the details out of the Xbox Direct, such as Fable, Beast of Reincarnation. You can follow us on all the social media sites. Just search for RPG space site, and you should be able to find us. We have a Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite. On whatever service you listen to this podcast on, leave us a like, leave us a rating. We'd love to see those. Leave a comment as well. I think I covered everything. I step away for a week. I'm like, what are all the things I got to run through at the end? I think I got it all. But we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll see you next week.